their two injured opponents. "Now that we've got them, what do we do with them?" asked Remy. "Hold this." Sam handed her his pistol, so she now had one pistol aimed at each fallen enemy. Sam knelt, tugged off the two men's boots, then pulled the long leather laces out and used them to hogtie the two. He stood. "I guess that's the best we can do for the moment," he said. "We've got to get back to the site while they search. We're the only ones who've seen the Codex." Sam walked up the jungle path, carrying the two pairs of boots. Remy looked back once at the two incapacitated men, then hurried after him. Chapter 22. The Ruined City. Sam and Remy approached the forested edge of the open plaza and stopped for a moment to exchange a brief embrace. Remy said, "Remind me never to get a chemical peel." "I doubt that you'll forget, but I think his was worse than most," Sam said.
"Yes. It's amazing what some men will do for a little extra beauty."
Sam chuckled. They returned to the great plaza and saw it was dominated by two big CH-47 Chinook troop carrier helicopters that had set down on both ends of the cleared space. Soldiers in battle dress had taken positions in various parts of the ruin, and there was a squad surrounding the sun awning, where Sarah Allersby and her group stood uneasily while Commander Rueda spoke with her. Sarah Allersby raised her eyes and looked stricken when she saw Sam and Remy arrive, looking a bit disheveled, sweaty, and dirty.
"Hello, Sarah," said Remy.
"How dare you come back here?"
Sarah Allersby turned toward Commander Rueda.
"I just had some men escort these interlopers away from this vulnerable site."
Sam said, "What she means is that she gave two of her thugs her blessing to murder us in the jungle."
"That's absurd. Me? That's laughable."
As though to prove it, Sarah managed an unconvincing laugh. Commander Rueda said,
"Everyone save this conversation for headquarters."
He turned to the lieutenant in charge of the squad. "You and your men search everything. Tents, helicopters, every bag, box, or case."
"You have no right to do that,"
Sarah Allersby protested.
"You'll have your chance to argue with our methods in court."
"I'll remember you said that," she said coldly.
Sam said, "Commander, we left the two men who were supposed to kill us tied up in the jungle. We shouldn't really leave them like that."
"Of course," said Commander Rueda. He turned to the lieutenant again. "Assign three men to go with the Fargos and take the suspect into custody."
Remy took a step, but Sam held her back. "You've earned a rest." He moved his eyes in the direction of the men searching Sarah Allersby's campsite. Remy nodded in agreement, and Sam kissed her cheek. "Nice work back there. See you in a little while." Sam walked across the plaza with the three soldiers. As he walked, he noticed that Rueda's soldiers had lined up the armed guards in a shaded area by the pyramid. Their rifles were stacked in a pile 100 feet away. Sam led the men along the path. The distance Ruiz and Russell had taken them came as a bit of a surprise to Sam. On the first trip, he had been trying to make the walk as slowly as possible to give the federal police time to get here. On the way back, he and Remy had been running. This time, the mile of jungle path seemed to take forever. But at last, he reached the little valley where Ruiz and Russell had taken them. Russell and Ruiz were gone. Sam was silent for a moment while the three soldiers looked at him. He pointed at the spot. "This is where we left them tied up. I guess I did a bad job of tying." The sergeant said,
"Are you sure this is the place?"
Sam pointed. "There's the grave they had me dig." One of the soldiers squatted nearby.
"I found something," he said. "One of them rolled from there to here, where the other one was."
He picked up a strip of leather from the ground and examined it closely. He chewed through the other one's leather cord.
"I should have thought of that, and tied them to trees," Sam said.
"Maybe we can pick up their trail." The soldier, who seemed to be a tracker, walked around the perimeter of the clearing, staring at the ground, then touching the foliage. He started into the jungle, then came back, tried another place, and came back.
"I can't find any footprints. I don't know which way to go.
They're barefoot, said Sam. We took their boots, so there won't be any boot prints.
The sergeant shrugged. They won't get far barefoot. They'll have to go back to the camp or die out here.
Sam stared at the ground for a few seconds, reluctant to give up. The three soldiers began to move off up the path, and Sam turned to follow. He stopped, walked through the bushes around the clearing, but found nothing. Finally, he sighed, then trotted off after the soldiers. When Sam and his companions returned to the plaza, the army helicopter's doors were open and people were climbing aboard. Soldiers loaded the two civilian copters with the camera equipment, folded tents, and supplies. The camera crew, Sarah Allersby's assistants, and the dig supervisors got in. What caught Sam's eye was Sarah Allersby in handcuffs, being escorted by Commander Rueda to one of the two big military helicopters. Remy stood, waiting for Sam at the field. She ran to meet him.
Where are they?
One of them rolled over to where the other one was and chewed through his leather shoelace. They got away.
I'll bet it was Ruiz, Remy said. He has beautiful teeth.
The sergeant says they'll never get anywhere on foot. On the other hand, I keep remembering that lots of people in this part of the world don't have shoes. What's going on?
Rueda said that Sarah had photocopies of the four pages of the codex that made up the map in her suitcase, with this site marked. She also had aerial photos of the same four sites we picked out, and a few more. It's not the codex, but it's proof that she at least had the original codex long enough to photograph it.
She's under arrest?
Remy nodded. She's on her way to be booked in Guatemala City for possession of stolen property and for damaging this site. I think Rueda wants to arrange something public to discourage the other people who do this kind of thing.
If we want a ride to civilization, we'd better go retrieve our backpacks, said Sam.
I did that while you were gone, she whispered. I also went back to retrieve our pistols in the woods. I broke them down and put the pieces in the packs. I've already put them aboard.
Good thinking. Thanks. Sam looked around him as the soldiers climbed into the helicopters. A half dozen of them remained near the pyramid, setting up a camp of their own to guard the site. We'd better get seats in the chopper before they run out of room. Remy climbed in, and Sam followed. There were seats of crisscross nylon netting along both walls. They selected a pair, strapped themselves in, and a minute later the engine growled to life, and then lifted the big chopper into the air.
Jerry Ruiz looked up at the sky. First one, then another, then the last two helicopters soared overhead. He judged that they were moving southward toward Guatemala City.
It's safe to head back to the pyramid now, Russell said. Two of those were definitely the big troop carriers.
Okay, let's go, said Ruiz. Keep your eyes open to see where Fargo threw our boots.
Russell walked for a few feet, then stepped on a sharp stone, hopped on one foot, and landed on a pointed stick in the path.
Oh! Ah!
He said, sat on the path and stared at the soles of both feet, then got up again and moved ahead gingerly. Russell's already red and painful face now looked worse. Much of the sandy gravel that Sam Fargo had thrown in it had been stuck to his raw skin and was held there by the Vaseline, and when he'd been hog-tied on the ground, his face had also picked up more dirt, grass, and small sticks.
Ruiz wisely said nothing. There was no need to remind Russell of his face, or to warn him that the path was treacherous and studded with sharp stones, or that the low brush on both sides had thorns. Russell had already sworn about it 6 or 7 times in the last 10 minutes. Ruiz had trouble walking, too. The shovel had left a shallow cut and a large bruise on his leg just above the knee. His right hand hurt, and his breathing was labored because of some damage to a rib or two. Nevertheless, he had managed to roll over to where Russell lay and chew his way through Russell's leather bonds. It had not been easy, but he'd known that they had to get free or they'd be dragged into the Guatemala City jail and charged with attempted murder. And even if the soldiers didn't find them,
They could easily die out here.
Ruiz had been raised in a remote village in Mexico. He knew that two bleeding, helpless men could hardly go unnoticed by the jaguars that patrolled the jungles at night. He also knew that the worst dangers didn't always look the worst. Fatal malaria, Chagas disease, or dengue fever could come from the bite of a tiny insect. So he had done what was necessary to free them. They'd lain still in the jungle, covered with fallen leaves, while the soldiers came and went. Maybe now all would be well. But he was concerned about Russell, who had gotten a little crazy since he'd been painted blue. He was in a constant state of rage, goaded on by the pain in his face and the pain of his anger. Ruiz was worried. Poor judgment was a vulnerability. Mistakes one could shrug off in a city would kill a man out in the jungle. Ruiz hobbled off the path and selected 2 5-foot saplings from a stand of little trees growing where a big one had fallen, and broke off the branches to make 2 walking sticks.
Here. This will help.
Using their sticks, they moved on in silence for a time. Leaning on the sticks kept them from stepping down too hard on sharp stones, and gave them enough balance to avoid some of the worst spots. It took them about an hour to reach the ancient city. While they were still on the edge of the jungle, they could see that the whole site had been evacuated except for a half-dozen soldiers who loitered by the Great Pyramid's steps. They had built a small fire and pitched 3 2-man tents. Russell stepped toward the open area, but Ruiz held him back.
"Wait," said Ruiz. "They're soldiers."
"I can see that."
"What if they've been left here to wait for us?" asked Ruiz.
Russell stopped and thought, but he didn't seem to be getting anywhere. Ruiz prompted him.
"The Fargos must have told the soldiers we tried to kill them."
Russell said, "All this is beside the point. We're 100 miles from anywhere. We don't have shoes, water, or food. They do.
They also have guns. Assault rifles, full auto," said Ruiz.
"We can wait until they're asleep, crawl up, and cut their throats."
"There are 6, 2 in each tent. Even if each of us could kill 2 men in a tent with a knife we don't have, the one would yell while the other was being killed. There would still be 2 in another tent who would hear it and open fire on us."
"We can't walk out of here barefoot," said Russell. "It's too far to civilization."
"Wait," said Ruiz. "Look over there. They left the sun awning up. We can wrap our feet in the canvas and walk out."
Russell's expression made him look like a wounded animal, but when he saw what Ruiz was talking about, he seemed to calm down.
"Okay, let's try it. I don't want to get into a fight with 6 men any more than you do."
Ruiz was relieved.
"I'll go get the canvas."
Without waiting for an answer, he started off in the jungle outside the open space. The rough, unpredictable ground tortured his feet, but he got there. He looked in the direction of the pyramid to be sure the soldiers by the steps couldn't see him. Then he used the sharp end of one of the aluminum poles to cut a hole in the canvas, tore a large swatch of the fabric off, rolled it up, and carried it with him. When he reached Russell, they tore 4 squares, put a foot in the center of each, and used the remnants of their leather shoelaces to tie the canvas around their ankles. They looked at the late afternoon shadows of the buildings on the plaza to judge the compass points, took up their walking sticks, and began to hobble off into the jungle toward the south.
"Next time, I won't fool around with neatness," Russell said. "No grave digging, no taking them off somewhere else so nobody ever knows. If I see them, I'll open fire. If there are witnesses, I'll shoot them too."
As Ruiz and Russell made their way along the jungle paths, Ruiz had to listen to a constant, unending litany of complaints. Each time Russell started up again, he promised to kill Sam and Remy Fargo in more elaborate and time-consuming ways. Ruiz walked in silence. Some might have advised that talking would have eased the pain in Ruiz's feet, ribs, and hand.
but the pain served to take his attention away from Russell's complaints, and that was enough for now. Later on, if he and Russell ever made it through this green prison and Ruiz kept the use of his limbs, he would be happy to talk about the killing.
Chapter 23, Guatemala City. The arraignment was held a few days later in the Central Court Building in Guatemala City. Sam and Remy arrived with Amy Costa from the embassy. As soon as they were seated, Costa said, "Uh-oh. I don't like the look of this." "What is it?" asked Remy.
"I'm not sure yet," said Amy. "But it looks as though this isn't going to go the way we thought. Take a look at the row of men sitting behind the defense table."
Remy held up a compact, ostensibly to check her makeup, and used the mirror to study each man. There were six of them, in expensive tailored suits. About half the people in Guatemala were of Mayan descent, and most of the rest were mestizos. But these men all looked about as Spanish as the people Sam and Remy had met in Valladolid while they were looking for the Las Casas papers.
"Who are they?"
"The Minister of the Interior, the Chief Judge of the Courts, two important commerce officials, two senior political advisers to the President."
"What does it mean?"
"It's like the bride's side and the groom's side at a wedding. They're sitting on the defendant's side."
"Are you surprised?" asked Remy.
"I suppose I shouldn't be, but I am. In 2008, the country set up the International Commission Against Impunity. It was formed to clean up the court system and rid the country of illegal security forces just like the one you faced in Alta Verapaz. At least three of these men are members. I guess they're not against impunity for their friends." A moment later, a side door of the courtroom opened, and Sarah Allersby was escorted in by two police officers, who were followed by the Allersby attorneys. Remy nudged Sam.
"Look familiar?"
Sam whispered to Amy, "The first three are the team who came to our house to make the offer for the Codex." The Mexican, American, and Guatemalan attorneys who had been at that meeting were joined by three others.
"The other three are partners in a respected local law firm," Amy said.
Sarah Allersby and the lawyers all remained standing. After a moment, the bailiff called the court to order, and the judge came in, climbed the steps to the bench, and sat. He hammered the gavel a couple of times and called for order. Everyone sat down. Just as the cloth of the judge's robe touched his chair, attorneys from both the defense and the prosecution hurried to the bench. They conferred with the judge for several minutes. Sam whispered,
"I don't see any arguing."
"Neither do I,"
Amy whispered.
"I think the case has been settled."
"How could it be?" asked Sam.
"And if it is, what are all the important men doing here?"
asked Remy.
"I'm guessing they're lending the weight of their support to the winning side. So even if justice is blind, it won't be foolish enough to cause trouble."
The judge made an impatient gesture at the attorneys, who all scurried away like a flock of chickens and dispersed to their places behind the tables.
"The court has received the following settlement proposed by Miss Allersby's counsel and seconded by the people of Guatemala."
"Why would the prosecution settle?" said Sam. Several people nearby turned to look at him with disapproval. The judge consulted his notes, then began again. Amy translated.
"The charge of possession of a Mayan codex should be dismissed for lack of evidence. No such book was found. The charge of threatening people with violence should be dismissed. The two supposed suspects were never found."
"That's ridiculous," Sam said. "Don't the police get to produce evidence?" There was a murmuring, and people turned to stare a second time. The judge rapped his gavel and glared at Sam. Amy Costa whispered,
"He's considering clearing the courtroom. Please stay calm or he'll throw everyone out, and we might have to wait weeks for transcripts."
The judge set aside the paper he had been reading and picked up another. He began to read again in Spanish.
"I'm not catching that," said Sam. "What's he saying?"
"Miss Allersby is claiming to be the uncontested discoverer of the ruined city.
She's asked for a 99-year lease on the land in exchange for a sum of money to be used by the Interior Ministry to protect wildlife in the Alta Verapaz district.
Unbelievable.
Amy Costa whispered, "He's describing the negotiated settlement. That doesn't mean he'll accept it. Nothing you say will change the terms."
Sam sat still, watching in silence.
Amy whispered, "Now it's Commander Rueda. She has asked that he be reassigned so he can't retaliate against her."
Sam winced and looked down at his shoes, but said nothing.
Amy Costa listened for a moment while the judge said something in a loud, stern voice.
Amy translated, "I approve the terms of the settlement and declare this case closed."
He rapped his gavel.
Amy Costa stood up, as a number of other spectators were doing, so they could clear out before the next case began.
"Come on,"
she whispered to Sam and Remy.
Sam said, "What? It's over? We can't testify or present any evidence?"
He stood. Remy watched while half the courtroom turned to stare at Sam again. One of the people who turned to look at Sam was Sarah Allersby. A barely detectable smile of delighted amusement played on her lips for a second, and she turned to face forward again.
"No,"
said Amy Costa.
"It was settled out of court ahead of time. It happens everywhere."
"This time it's a fraud. The richest person doesn't just win. She never even gets charged."
Sam didn't need any translation when the judge pounded his gavel and ordered, "Remove that man from the court." He stood and stepped to the aisle.
"Don't bother. I'll remove myself."
It was too late. The order had been given. Two large police officers seized him. One twisted his arm behind his back and the other placed him in a headlock. As they hustled him down the aisle, pushed the double doors open with his head, and kept going down the hall. When they reached the larger doors at the entrance to the building, they pushed them open with their free hands and then released Sam with a little push toward the steps. When Sam found himself outside the imposing building, where the rush of people and traffic surrounded him, he was relieved. He had already been mentally preparing himself for a booking session and a night in the Guatemala City jail. He stopped and waited for Remy and Amy, who appeared a moment later. As they walked down the steps, Remy said,
"I know he's a friend of yours. I'm so sorry that we got him in trouble."
The evidence against Sarah Allersby really was conclusive. You can't take a picture of something that isn't in your possession.
"Don't worry,"
Amy said. "Commander Rueda knew what he was doing, and he'll be fine. He has allies, too. And in a week, after this is forgotten, they'll go to work on his behalf. This is how countries go from corrupt little backwaters to modern nations. People have to push them every step of the way. People like Commander Rueda and people like you."
She gave Sam and Remy a sharp look.
"Don't let up on Sarah."
She turned and walked off toward the American Embassy, leaving Sam and Remy standing in front of the courthouse.
"Come on, let's go,"
said Remy. "I don't want to be standing here when Sarah Allersby comes out, gloating over her great victory."
Remy and Sam walked along the street in the direction of their hotel.
"So what do you want to do?"
she asked.
Sam shrugged. "I don't think we can let her go on doing this kind of thing, do you?"
"No.
But what can we do about it?" "We use the Las Casas copy of the Mayan Codex to figure out where she's going, and beat her to it." He smiled. "Then we do it again. And again. And again."
Chapter 24. Alta Verapaz, Guatemala. Sam and Remy sat in the passenger seats of the Bell 206B3 Jet Ranger helicopter with their earphones on to cut the noise, while Tim Carmichael, president and chief pilot of Cormorant One Air Charter, guided the craft above the endless miles of green treetops. Carmichael spoke over the radio in his Australian accent.
"We should be at your next set of coordinates in a few minutes."
"Great," said Sam. "We spend one day at each site. At the end of each day, we climb aboard the helicopter and get out of the jungle for the night.
The following morning, we fly to a new site. It's the perfect job for a charter, said Carmichael. Fly in, take a nap, fly out.
The sites have all been pretty remote, said Remy, and all of them are in heavily forested parts of the highlands.
Carmichael smiled. No worries. We've been in this business since the 1960s, and we haven't lost anyone this week.
Good enough for me, said Sam. Here's the aerial shot. He handed Carmichael an enlarged photograph with the coordinates marked on it in the white border.
Carmichael stared at it, checked the coordinates on his GPS, and handed the photograph back.
We should be there in under 5 minutes.
They looked out at the treetops. There were ranges of low bluish mountains in the distance, a deep blue sky, and puffs of unthreatening white clouds. Earlier they had seen a few roads and small towns, but it had been a long time since they had seen any signs of human inhabitants. Carmichael looked at the GPS.
There.
Remy pointed at a place in the jungle canopy where gray stone protruded between trees.
It's right over there.
Carmichael brought the Jet Ranger around, tipped at an angle so they could look at the site as he circled it.
"We definitely see something the color of limestone," he said. "It comes right up through the trees."
"That's it," said Sam. "Let's find a place to land." Carmichael widened the circles, spiraling outward from the ruins. After a few minutes, he said,
"I don't see anything that looks like clear ground."
"No," Remy said. "It's all thickly forested."
Carmichael went farther out until he found a spot that was empty of trees. It was a patch of jungle that had burned to the ground.
Carmichael said, "Finally. That'll have to do."
"It looks like there must have been a fire," said Sam. "Everything's charred."
"Yeah," said Carmichael. "Way out here, it was probably a lightning strike the last time it rained. I'm afraid you'll have a long walk to the ruins, though."
"I have an idea," Remy said.
"Is that rescue gear working?"
She pointed at the side door in the bay where there was an electric winch and a cable with a harness.
"Sure,"
Carmichael said.
"Can you operate the winch while you're flying?"
"I've got a second set of controls right here. I can sit down here, rig you up, and lower you over the site, if you're up to it. But I have to warn you, that's a scary ride."
Remy said, "I know, but we don't mind."
Carmichael looked at Sam for a reaction. Sam said, "We can rig ourselves up. Do you think you can set us down on the upper part of that gray stone? It seems to be the top of a building."
"There's not much wind today. I'm willing to give it a try if you are."
"Remy, want me to go first?" asked Sam.
"Nope," she said. "Help me get rigged."
Sam and Remy unbuckled their seatbelts, climbed over the seats to the back, and then got Remy into the harness.
"Okay, Tim, let's see where we can lower her."
They flew in lower and hovered over the spot where they had seen the gray limestone structure jutting through the treetops.
"Ready?"
asked Carmichael. Sam opened the side door. Remy sat on the edge with her legs dangling out, waved goodbye to Sam, and slid out the door, the rotor wash blowing her ponytail around wildly.
"Now," said Sam.
The winch lowered Remy as Sam watched her progress.
"Lower, lower, lower.
Hold there, Tim. Just hover."
Remy reached the gray stone surface, then freed herself of the rescue gear.
"She's removing the harness."
"Okay, she's clear. Raise the cable."
When the empty harness came up, Sam slipped into it and picked up his and Remy's day packs by the straps. He sat on the floor of the open doorway.
"Okay, Tim, come back for us at 5.
"I'll be here."
Sam slid out and watched the top of the pyramid coming closer and closer as the winch lowered him to its top tier. There was a small temple on top, and he had to use his feet to keep from swinging into it, but then he was on the platform and the cable went slack. He slipped it off, then waved to Tim to raise it. Tim's helicopter rose straight up, and he activated the winch to bring the harness up as he flew off to the west toward the burned clearing. Sam and Remy began to look through their packs. Remy said, "Pretty quiet all of a sudden, isn't it?" He put his arms around her and kissed her.
"It's kind of nice to be alone."
"It is," she said.
But if we don't get this place photographed, we'll have to come back tomorrow.
Let's get it done. Each of them opened a day pack, took out a pistol, stuck it in the belly band they both wore under their shirts, and then took out a digital camera. They worked systematically, taking shots from each side of the pyramid, so that in all four directions they photographed a quarter of the surrounding city complex, which looked like an arrangement of steep hills covered by trees. They went into the house-sized temple atop the pyramid and took photographs of its walls, floor, and ceiling. The temple had two rooms plastered with stucco and then painted with murals that were in fairly good shape. They depicted a procession of Mayan people bringing bowls and plates to a hideous figure who must have been a god. They slowly descended the pyramid, taking photographs of it, of the steps, of the monumental buildings in every direction. Much of the time, each of them included the other person in the photograph to establish scale and to prove that they had been there. When they reached the ground level, they walked a quarter of a mile in each of the four directions from the pyramid, still photographing everything they could see. At the end of the afternoon, they returned to the foot of the pyramid and stopped on the east side. Sam took a foot-length section of PVC pipe, capped and sealed on both ends from his pack. Inside were rolled papers, printed statements in English and Spanish. They said that Remy and Sam Fargo had been at this GPS position on this date to explore and map these Mayan ruins. There were also telephone numbers, email addresses, and street addresses for contacting the Society for American Archaeology, the World Archaeological Congress, and the Society for Historical Archaeology, all of which had been notified of the discovery, as had the Guatemalan government. Sam dug a hole and buried the pipe in front of the eastern steps and then marked the spot with a small red plastic flag, like the ones the gas companies use to mark gas lines.
"So much for that," said Remy. "I feel a little like the old-time explorers who used to plant flags on other people's property and say they owned it."
"Let's just settle on the idea that we were here and registered it with the people who are qualified to study it and learn more about it," he said. "That's enough for me."
"And this is our fifth city," Remy said. "Four major cities in 10 days.
We must be the world's greatest tourists."
Remy looked at her watch. "It's after 4. Let's climb up on our perch and get a phone connection with Selma's computer so we can send her our photographs."
As they moved up the enormous work of earth and stone, they could see trees nearly as tall on all sides. At the top, Remy turned on her satellite phone, connected it to her camera, and sent her cache of photographs to Selma's computer in San Diego. They had arranged at their first site that Selma would save all of the material and then forward it to David Kane at the university. He in turn would notify all of the international organizations that another previously unknown Mayan city had been found, partially mapped, and photographed. When Remy had transferred her photographs, she took Sam's camera and transferred his. She looked at her watch again and said, "It's almost 5. Didn't Tim say he was coming at 5?
"Yes."
Sam took his satellite phone and called Tim Carmichael. He heard the sound of ringing for a minute, then hung up.
"He's not answering."
"He's probably flying, and he can't hear the phone with the earphones on."
They waited about 10 more minutes, listening for the sound of a helicopter, and then Remy said,
"Nothing."
Sam called again, then hung up. He called the office of Cormorant One Air Charter in Belize and put on the speaker so Remy could hear.
"Cormorant, Aunt Bowen."
"Mr. Bowen, we haven't met. This is Sam Fargo. Tim Carmichael took us to a spot in the highlands of Guatemala. He was supposed to pick us up at 5, but he hasn't. He's not answering his satellite phone. I wondered if you could please get him on the radio and check to be sure he's all right."
"I'll try," said Bowen. "Hold on."
Bowen went away from the phone for a minute. More time passed, and Sam and Remy could hear low voices in the background. Bowen might have been on the radio, or he might have been talking to someone in his office. After a few more minutes, he was back.
"He's not answering his radio either," said Bowen. "We're going to send another helicopter out there and see what's up. Can you give me your exact position?
Hold on. Sam handed the phone to Remy, who had their notes in her day pack. She read the coordinates to Bowen, then repeated them. She gave him her satellite phone number and Sam's.
Tim was going to wait for us about 5 miles due west of our current position, on a flat space that looked as though it had been recently burned.
And can you be seen from the air?
We're standing on top of a Mayan pyramid. Tim lowered us on a rescue cable, and he was going to pick us up the same way.
I'm going to come get you myself, but I don't have a chopper here with that kind of equipment on it right now. Is there a place I can land and get you?
We'll have to walk to the place where Tim landed. Everywhere else in any direction seems to be covered with vegetation.
If that's the only option, okay, but do it carefully. Don't count on the idea that anybody you meet out there is okay. There are a lot of criminals in a wild country, where the police and the army can't find them. I'm bringing 2 men with me, and we'll be armed.
Thanks for the warning.
We'll do our best not to make contact with anybody. We're heading for the landing site right now. We'll probably get there about the same time. See you there.
As Sam and Remy scrambled down the side of the pyramid, they oriented themselves to the west, where Tim Carmichael had gone to land. Remy said, I hope Tim didn't catch a rotor on a tree branch or something and crash.
I hope he didn't either, said Sam. I couldn't see any smoke from up on the pyramid, but there's no guarantee there would be a fire. Anything could have happened.
I hate to get all worried when we're too far away to even know what to worry about.
I'm withholding my anxiety, Sam said. But only to the extent that I'm leaving the first aid kit in my pack and the safety on my pistol. As Sam and Remy began to be sure of their footing, leaving the base of the pyramid, they sped up. They trotted when the path was clear and walked at a strong, steady pace when the vegetation was thick. They navigated by walking toward the glare of the late afternoon sun on the tree leaves. They estimated that over a long period, their walking and trotting probably averaged 3 miles an hour, and so they kept at it for a half hour before they stopped to check their GPS position. They sat on a stone outcropping, drank water, and caught their breath while they reoriented themselves. They had come about halfway, and they agreed that this time they would go for 15 minutes before they stopped again to check their position. They ran steadily in single file, still using the reflected sun to navigate. They concentrated on making progress, but as time went on, they began to pay more attention to making as little noise as possible. They knew that Tim Carmichael wasn't the type to simply show up late, or to take them into the wilderness in an aircraft that wasn't well-maintained and fueled to capacity. He had a radio in the helicopter as well as a satellite phone. There was no way to know what had gone wrong until they got to the landing spot, but neither imagined the story would be a happy one. Their thoughts centered on the hope that Tim wasn't dead. At the end of their third leg of silent jogging, they were very close to the patch where Tim Carmichael had said he'd land. There was no helicopter sound in the air, which meant that Art Bowen was not yet close with a second helicopter. The silence was thick and ominous. Sam and Remy stood cheek to cheek so that they could whisper in each other's ears to keep their conference silent. They agreed on a plan of approach, drank more water, and moved on. They walked, staying low and alert until they reached the burned land. They peered out of the thick foliage that had been spared by the fire and saw Carmichael's Jet Ranger. It had landed in the cleared field, far from any trees that could have interfered with its rotors. The land was quite level, and the helicopter sat evenly. There was nothing out of place, and there were no bullet holes. But there also was no sign of Tim. Slowly, Sam and Remy moved along the perimeter of the cleared area. When they had gone about 100 yards, they stopped suddenly and listened. There were voices. At first they wondered if they were hearing the helicopter's radio. These were male voices speaking Spanish. The voices came from behind them. Sam and Remy turned to face the sounds coming from the forest. They were between the grounded helicopter and a group of men. They could see a path that had been trampled in the brush recently.
The bent and broken plants still had green leaves. Remy gestured to Sam that she would go around the men to the right. Sam nodded and began to make his way to the left so he and Remy would be positioned on both sides of the group. They both stayed well back from the group, where they could not easily be seen and where any noises they made might be lost in the men's conversation.
Sam made a 90-degree arc around the sounds, then stopped and waited. He knew Remy would already be in position. Her sure-footed fencer's body could move through vegetation better than his, and he knew that when he moved in, he could initiate the most frightening close-in attack, while Remy, the pistol champion, could do much more damage from a moderate distance. He took the pistol from his belly and began to crawl toward the voices. It sounded to him like six men, and they seemed to be close, arranged in a circle. Maybe they were sitting around a fire. No. He would have smelled the fire. Around a circle, anyway. What were they doing way out here? And then he saw them. There were actually five men in their 20s, unshaven and wearing jeans, khakis, bits of old military uniforms, t-shirts. On the ground in the center of their circle, they had laid out an olive drab plastic tarp. Spread on it were Tim Carmichael's belongings, his satellite phone, all three sets of earphones, the maps from the helicopter, his wallet, his keys, pocket knife, sunglasses. Set on the ground beside each of the five men was a Belgian FN-FAL 7.62mm military rifle. Sam moved closer, searching for some sign of what had happened to Tim Carmichael. And then he saw him. Tim was a few feet off, at the edge of the thicker vegetation. Carmichael was standing, his hands tied behind his back, his ankles tied. He had a noose around his neck, the rope thrown over a thick limb of the tree above him and then securely tied to the trunk. If he got tired, he still had to stand. If he leaned, the noose tightened around his neck. His left eye was black and swollen. He had scrapes on his face and grass stains on his clothes, and his hair was stuck together on top of his head from drying blood from a blow to the skull. Sam worked his way around the clearing at a distance, trying hard to avoid discovery. When he was directly behind Carmichael, he slowly crawled to him through the thick jungle vegetation. Staying hidden by the trees and Carmichael's body, Sam reached out with his knife and sawed through the rope at Carmichael's wrists, then his ankles. He took out his second pistol, switched off the safety, and placed it in Carmichael's right hand. Then he crawled a few feet farther and cut the rope from Tim's noose where it was secured to the tree trunk. He tucked an inch of the rope end into the remaining loop of rope behind the tree so it would look the same. Sam crawled backward, retreating deeper into the brush. He took his time, selecting a spot where he, Remy, and Tim would have the men in a perfect crossfire. Now and then, one of the men around the tarp would turn and glance at Carmichael and see that he was still standing with his hands behind his back and the noose around his neck. When Sam judged that he, Remy, and Carmichael were each 120 degrees apart on the circle, he raised his pistol, stepped close to the circle, placed his body behind the trunk of a tree, and showed only his right eye and his gun hand. "You!" he shouted in Spanish. "Leave those guns on the ground and step away from them!" The men were startled and jerked their heads toward Sam's voice. One started to raise his rifle, but Sam fired, and the man collapsed backward. Carmichael shouted, "Drop the guns!" Some of the men looked and saw he was suddenly free, aiming a gun at them. They set their rifles back down. One man saw this as unacceptable, pivoted with his rifle to aim at Carmichael, but Carmichael was no longer visible. He had slipped into the bushes. The man raised his weapon to aim, but a shot was fired from Remy's side of the circle. It hit his arm and made him drop the rifle on the ground. The remaining men moved back from their rifles and put their hands on their heads. Sam came out from behind his tree, knowing Remy and Carmichael were covering him. He kept his gun on the men as he took each rifle and tossed it to his side of the clearing so they formed a pile. When Sam had the rifles, Tim Carmichael showed himself, holding Sam's second pistol on his captor's. Sam said, "Are you hurt?" "Just a little. None of these clowns shot me anyway."
Do you know who they are?
They're as talkative as a bunch of crows, but they never said anything to reveal that. I guess they're just a bunch of guys who saw the helicopter, knew it was valuable, and tried to take it.
Is your helicopter all right?
It's fine. I thought I'd get out of it and take a nap in the shade. When I woke up, I had already lost a fist fight.
The sound of a helicopter in the distance drew their attention. The roar grew louder, the leaves on trees began to whip back and forth in the wind, and the helicopter hovered. Looking up, Sam and Remy could see through the treetops that there was a man in an open doorway holding an M16 rifle.
"Maybe you'd better let them see you, Tim," said Sam.
Carmichael stepped into the area by his helicopter and waved both arms while Sam and Remy kept their guns on their prisoners. The radio in Tim's helicopter squealed.
"We see you, Tim. You all right?"
It was the voice of Aunt Bowen. Tim snatched the microphone.
"Yes, the Fargos are here with me. We've got 5 prisoners, 2 of them wounded."
"Sit tight. We're coming in." The helicopter landed, and 3 men came running, carrying M16 rifles. The middle-aged, stocky man piloting the helicopter came more slowly, but he was also armed with an M16. As Sam and Remy walked with Tim Carmichael to watch Art Bowen and his men load the 5 prisoners into the helicopters, Remy said, "I'll bet Tim would like to take a few days off after this." Carmichael climbed into the pilot seat and put on his just-recovered sunglasses.
"You know, I just might. When I was listening to those 5 talk, I realized that the only reason I'm alive is that, without me, they couldn't move the helicopter."
Chapter 25. The Burned Patch in Alta Verapaz. 3 weeks later. Sarah Ellersby walked from the pair of parked helicopters into the thick Guatemalan forest. The brush had grown over this trail 1,000 years ago, so it would be difficult to demonstrate to her guests that this was a Mayan trail, although she was sure it was. She hacked her way along with a machete, watching her feet to find a spot that would be clear enough for the revelation. She glanced back along the trail. There were 15 journalists, all of them carrying complicated camera equipment and recorders and satellite phones. But they were all chattering away with one another about God knows what. They weren't paying attention to the special place where she had brought them. Sarah looked down and stopped, then called for their attention.
"Look, everyone. We're on a Mayan thoroughfare. It's a paved foot road."
She stepped aside to let the journalists come forward to take pictures of the pavement. A few listlessly snapped the ground with its layer of whitish cobbles, but more were inclined to take photographs of Sarah hacking through the overgrowth. That, she reflected, was all right, too. She pushed ahead, then looked back beyond the photographers at the longer line of armed men she had brought into the jungle, carrying their Belgian rifles. It was costing her a great deal of money, but this time she was going to be sure she had the manpower to keep everything under control. After the disappearance of the 5 men Russell had sent to clear the helicopter landing spot, she had left little to chance. She knew the ruin was only a short distance away now, so she kept moving, hacking at the vines and brush in her way. She finally burst through the bush and stepped onto the great plaza.
"There," she shouted. "There is the city, the lost city I've found."
She stepped boldly forward on the plaza. Ahead of her, on both sides of the wide open space, were huge pyramids, and to her side was the biggest one so far. And while the reporters were ignorant about the structure, she had already seen the beautiful paintings on stucco inside the temple at its top. The architecture and art revealed a society that had been rich and complicated, colorful and full of life, and the place had been abandoned before the Normans invaded England. There were sure to be hordes of priceless artifacts hidden deep in the royal tombs of a place this size. It was spectacular. She had already found a few things, and they had stimulated her appetite. But even more,
She wanted these news people to see her doing some excavating. A couple of photographs and some actual footage that could be shown on television in Europe and the United States would further the process of her transformation. Right now, she was dismissed as just one more heiress with exotic tastes. When her discoveries were all revealed, she would be a major power in the world of archaeology. Nobody would know her discoveries had all come from her Mayan codex, so she could still stage a discovery of it years from now, and get full credit for that, too. She was perfectly dressed in a tailored explorer's outfit, a tan shirt with epaulets and the sleeves rolled up, tailored pants in the same fabric, and polished boots, and she strode ahead with a kind of heroic energy, moving toward the huge pyramid that dominated the end of the plaza as though it were a beast she was conquering, when she heard a sudden wave of chatter behind her. She stopped and looked over her shoulder. The journalists had come about 30 yards into the great plaza. They all seemed to be awed by the enormous size and imposing character of the city's buildings, all of them partially sheathed in vegetation. Unlike most of the lost cities Sarah had visited, the tallest buildings were not totally obscured by the plants and dirt. Their outlines were fairly clear. But something was wrong. They weren't all rushing after her, elbowing one another to get close and congratulate her, to pepper her with questions about the city. They were all standing in a tight knot, looking down at their telephones and reading text or facing away from the others with their phones held to their ears. Others were facing one another, talking rapidly in their various languages, as though they were discussing some piece of astonishing news. The only ones not in the gaggle of chattering riders were the photographers, who stood in a loose circle, filming not the miracle of human accomplishment that towered over them, but the reporters and their exclamations and questions and gestures of what seemed to be shock or outrage. One of the journalists in particular caught Sarah's attention. He was Justin Fraker from The Times, London, a classmate of her brother Teddy at Eton. He had come because Teddy had promised him something. She suspected it was an invitation to a future reception at number 10 Downing Street. She had high hopes that Justin would make the case for her at home. She stared at him now because he was the nearest of the English speakers, and it was easiest for her to read lips in English. He seemed to be saying, "This is insane. She must be joking. She can't be serious." She wondered who he could be talking about. She sighed. It would be just her luck if some American actress did something so outrageous that it took their attention away from her. She turned and walked back toward the crowd of newspeople. Michelle Fauré, a stringer for Paris Match, had agreed to come because of Sarah Allersby's reputation as a partygoer in Europe. She hurried toward Sarah, calling out, "Sarah! Sarah!" She was holding a small video camera. Sarah Allersby was reassured. The idea that she was about to become an even bigger celebrity was titillating. She had always liked being the very rich girl, with mysterious holdings in Central America, who would sometimes appear at parties in southern France or the islands of the Mediterranean. She sensed that she was about to go from interesting to fascinating. She smiled and said, "What is it, Michelle?"
"They are saying that you're a fraud. They say this site is already registered with all the archaeological organizations, that you didn't find it. Someone else did."
Sarah was not pleased that while Michelle was saying all this, the red light in the front of her video camera was on. She feigned an amused smile.
"That's silly," she said. "Why would I do such a thing?"
"Look at this," said Emil Bausch, the German columnist. He held up an iPad tablet with a photograph of the large pyramid that dominated the plaza. "This is a picture that's on the website of the Society for American Archaeology. This whole site has already been photographed and charted."
Jim Hargrove, an American from National Geographic, said, "How could this happen? Don't you consult any of the organizations in the field?"
"Of course I do."
Sarah hadn't done it lately. She had been so busy. "Apparently not often enough.
This set of ruins is on the lists of existing finds.
I don't know what you're talking about, said Sarah Allersby. Is this some kind of joke? I invited very few reporters here to share in an extremely rare experience. Are you now accusing me of faking something?
She waved her arm in the direction of the ancient buildings around them.
Did I build all this to fool you? These buildings are masterpieces, and the last people here left 1,000 years ago.
The people here left 3 weeks ago, said Justin Fraker. It's listed in the British catalogues of Discovery, too. He pointed at the image on his satellite phone. They've got a complete description. The map coordinates are identical, and they marked it with a pipe with a red flag that pokes out of the ground below the stairs.
Who are these people who supposedly left 3 weeks ago? Said Sarah Allersby.
The names listed are Samuel and Remy.
Fargo, she interrupted. They're criminals. People who have no qualifications or academic intent whatever. They're treasure hunters. This is a trick.
The find is listed as a joint project with the University of California, said Van Muckerjee, the New York Times correspondent. The University of California would seem to have academic qualifications and academic intent.
I have no more to say about these people, she said. I'll be leaving here in a half hour.
I would advise you all to make your way to the helicopter landing area as soon as possible. The pilots will not be flying anyone out after dark. She turned and began to walk along the path. Sarah held her shining blonde head high and walked in silence. The chosen group of journalists trotted after her, the photographers racing ahead so they could get a picture of her face with a snarl or a tear. Both sold a lot of papers.
Guatemala City. The next afternoon, Sarah Allersby sat in her bedroom and looked at her computer. Posted on YouTube was a video of Sarah Allersby. She looked beautiful and triumphant as she hacked her way through the brush and stepped onto the great plaza of the old city. Then almost immediately things changed. The news people were already preparing to surround her, saying in several languages that she was a fraud. It didn't matter whether the viewer could speak all of those languages, because the reporters yelling in his language would tell him the simple version of it. This site has already been discovered by someone else. This city is known. It's already registered with the international organizations. You're trying to fool everyone. As the accusations were repeated and amplified, Sarah walked quietly away from the mob of angry reporters. The reporters ran after her, then ahead of her, taking her picture and accusing her of worse and worse impostures. It went on and on. As Sarah watched on her computer, it made her want to cry for the poor, tormented woman in the video. Then the video faded out, and she saw the title, British Heiress Caught in Fraud. Views? 330,129. As she sat motionless, staring at the picture that was as motionless as she was, the number changed to 339,727. She clicked on the X at the corner of the screen to banish the sight, then stood up and walked away from the computer. She picked up the telephone and dialed a number she had called only a few times. This time, she was nervous.
Hello?
It was the voice of a young woman, probably one of the women who kept appearing on Diego San Martin's arm at parties and charity events, and then being replaced by another and another.
Hello.
Sarah's voice was honeyed, and her Spanish was sure and fluid.
This is Sarah Allersby. Is Señor San Martin available?
I'll see, the woman said carelessly. She dropped the phone on a hard surface. Sarah imagined her from her voice. His women were always models or actresses or beauty contest winners from Mexico or various South American countries. It was astounding how many of them there seemed to be, passing through a capital like Guatemala City, an endless supply. Sarah, San Martin's voice was gruff but friendly.
Good afternoon, Diego. I wondered if you and I could have a talk tomorrow.
Do you want to come here?
If you don't mind coming to my house, I would consider it a favor. Just now,